Toccata, this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall read to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Okay, let's start off a little bit from the Reader's Digest portion called The Healthy. And The Healthy is follows. This is kind of a smelly way to start things off on a Tuesday afternoon. An MD lists the 5 warning signs you have bad hygiene. It can feel like the only option in life is to cut corners when it comes to self-care. But these symptoms can indicate the true quality of your self-cleaning routine and how it might need a few tweaks here and there. And there's a picture of a gentleman in a shower. Be honest with yourself. That bath or shower time, maybe it's tempting to tend to the parts that get the smelliest, or sometimes to skip a rinse completely if you're spending the bulk of your days by yourself. But smelling sweet isn't all about making a good impression on others. A doctor specializing in hygiene advises that a few signs can actually serve as warnings that you're not cleansing yourself properly. Reader's Digest asked Dr. Rosmi Berrios, M.D., a medical doctor and master esthetician, to share a few of warning signs that someone has bad hygiene. These symptoms can result from a lack of regular bathing or showering, which can lead to the buildup of bacteria and dirt, Dr. Berrios says. Body odor. According to the Cleveland Clinic, body odor occurs when bacteria on your skin comes in contact with sweat. Because their body is already naturally covered with bacteria, when water, salt, and fat mixtures from your sweat mix with it, it can cause an odor. The particular smell of the odor, whether good or bad, usually depends on what you ate, your hormones, your medication, and more. Cleansing your body regularly with an antibacterial soap in the shower or bath is the best way to prevent that pungent aroma on your person. If you find particular areas that sweat or smell more than others, like armpits, take extra care of those, clean those spots well. Greasy hair. Experiencing an oily scalp. That's because your scalp produces sebum, that's S-E-B-U-M, I never heard of that, a natural oil that has antimicrobial properties. However, when it's not washed properly, the scalp can look greasy from the excess oil, which means it's time to wash your hair. If your scalp is greasy often, experts recommend using a mild shampoo without harsh chemicals, which can remove the natural oils in your scalp. However, if your hair is not greasy, you can likely go for a longer period of time before washing the hair again and letting the natural oils do their work. The frequency of how often you wash your hair would be dependent on how greasy it gets. Skin infections. Regularly cleansing your skin helps to eliminate germs, oils, and dead skin cells. But without it, your skin can show irritation, even allergy-like responses. This irritation and even potential infections can occur when the skin has a buildup of dead skin cells, germs, dirt, and sweat. Common skin infections that could occur because of poor hygiene and streptococcus, strep. These bacteria can lead to cellulitis and infections such as eczema, psoriasis, and fungal infection like athlete's foot. Another severe reaction due to poor hygiene is dermatitis, neglectica, which causes your skin to look darker, scaly, and rough. Bad breath. If someone has bad breath, not only following someone potent they ate, it's also very possible that they have poor oral hygiene. Bad breath is commonly known as halitosis, a medical condition that the Cleveland Clinic says can affect 1 out of 4 people around the globe. Brushing, flossing, and routine dental health cleanings are the key three steps to ensure that you have good dental hygiene and protection against not-so-heavenly breath. This is due to the harmful bacteria that remain in your mouth if you're not cleaning your teeth properly, which can lead to even more severe medical conditions like cavities or even gum disease. One of our editors is a longtime fan of TheraBreath mouthwash, which can be a game-changer. A water pick is also a great tool to clear bacteria and debris from the mouth and keeps the gums extra healthy and the mouth fresh. Note that halitosis can be a symptom of other serious medical conditions, like gastroesophageal reflux disease, GERD, tonsils, stones, and even head and neck cancers. If you are routinely cleaning your teeth but still find it hard to kick the bad breath, talk to your doctor about getting checked for some other conditions. Dirty and broken fingernails. Constantly dealing with broken nails? Find that your nails seem to always have a thin line of dirt underneath them? This may be due to not really routinely cleaning your nails, which should be a regular part of your hygiene routine. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, suggests nails should be vigilantly cleaned and trimmed often to keep them healthy and to prevent a spread of diseases like pinworm and E. coli. If your nails are not taken care of and cleaned, bacteria can remain around and under your fingernails. This can spread infections. In fact, national and state health departments' regulations typically don't permit frontline healthcare professionals and restaurant services to have long or acrylic nails. Regularly trimming your fingernails, then, cleaning them with soap, water, and a clean nail brush are key. And let's back up into a little more detail. How often should you change your toothbrush? Dentists reveal the healthiest timeline to replace your toothbrush, plus how COVID-19 pandemic has changed their recommendations, and clever Bristol sanitizing methods. When was the last time you cracked open a new toothbrush? I don't know. I never cracked a toothbrush before. Most of us probably don't remember. But according to a November 2022 report from the World Health Organization, it might be wise to pay closer attention. Almost half of the world's population, 45% or 3.5 billion people, suffer from oral diseases, the report states, adding global causes of oral diseases have increased by 1 million over the last 30 years, a clear indication that many people do not have access to prevention and treatment of oral diseases. So how often should you actually clean your toothbrush, check your teeth? If you want to stay on the right side of these statistics, the first step is knowing when to replace your toothbrush and how to care for it in between. Here's why you need to change your toothbrush. One of the main reasons to replace your toothbrush is bacterial buildup, says Allison Dugard, DDS, a dentist at Columbia Doctors and assistant professor of clinical dentistry at Columbia University Irving Medical Center. An old toothbrush can harbor bacteria that can cause bad breath, periodontal disease, and dental caries. Dental caries is a clinical term for tooth decay or cavities. Elizabeth Graves, gee, I know somebody named Elizabeth Graves, a registered dental hygienist, adds, when toothbrushes start to bristle start to break down, they aren't cleaning the food plaque of bacteria as effectively as they should. Signs it's time for replacement. They got a picture of a brand new toothbrush and one that looks like it's been through the wringer, really ragged. Bristles showing dark color changes should be growing a mold, which could lead to oral infections, says Dr. J. Salim, DMD, founder of Sutton Place Dental Associates in New York City. In addition, Dr. Hitesh Kaputa, DMD, founder of the Smile Factory, says that if the bristles are bent or broken in any way, it's time to replace your toothbrush. I recommend this method to my patients. Hold your toothbrush up in front of your face with the bristles facing outwards. If you can see any bristles from the back, they're bent enough to warrant the purchase of a new toothbrush. When to change your toothbrush? You should change your toothbrush every 3 or 4 months or when you see signs that your toothbrush is dirty and breaking down. If you're not a heavy brusher, you might not notice it when you need a new toothbrush. And if you can't be trusted, remember, you can use a toothbrush like Philips Sonicare rechargeable electric toothbrush that alerts you when it's time to change the brush head. How often should you change your toothbrush? The American Dental Association recommends changing your toothbrush every 3 or 4 months at minimum. However, Dr. Maria Ryan, DDS, Colgate-Palmolive's Chief Clinical Officer, says this year is different. The guidance is even more critical during flu season, and this year in particular with COVID and RSV also circulating at rapid rates, Dr. Ryan says. Those who don't dispose of their toothbrush risk getting sick again. If you've been sick, you should change your toothbrush immediately. I didn't know that. That's a good point. And if you have gum disease, you should change your toothbrush every 4 to 6 weeks. Many families or couples share a toothbrush holder in the bathroom, so if your toothbrush has been close to the toothbrush of someone who has been sick, I recommend replacing it, says Dr. Dugard. Clever ways to properly care for your toothbrush. Store your toothbrush in a safe, dry environment to prevent mold, Graves suggests, using toothbrush caps that track bacteria and moisture. You can use boiling water and let your toothbrush soak for 2 minutes, occasionally stirring it around to clean it. Leon Staff, CEO of the Cleaning Authority, recommends cleaning your toothbrush weekly to ensure it's fresh. Give it a quick clean and help remove bacteria or germs. Simply soak the toothbrush in antibacterial mouthwash or a small cup of hydrogen peroxide, Staff says. You might also soak your toothbrush in distilled vinegar, then let it air dry in an upright position. Just be sure to give it a really good rinse after the vinegar soak. Otherwise, that would be a pungent flavor on your toothbrush. Whitney DeFoggio, a registered dental hygienist, offers additional methods for keeping your toothbrush clean and bacteria-free. Antimicrobial mouthwash helps kill germs inside and outside of your mouth, so you consider leaving the toothbrush head down in a cup of mouthwash for 30 minutes, then setting it up to air dry, DeFoggio suggests. Another idea? Effervescent denture cleaner is great for dentures, she says, but you can also use it to soak your toothbrush as well. Let it sit in the cleanser for about half an hour or whatever the directions say, then rinse it off and allow it to air dry. What happens if you don't change your toothbrush? As bristles become more fragile and less compact, they become less effective at removing plaque from teeth and gums, explains Dr. Salim. Plaque is a sticky film invested with bacteria and food debris. The bacteria degrade organic food debris, producing acidic biochemicals, which can lead to cavities and gum disease. Dr. Salim explains that gum disease occurs when certain bacteria around and in between the teeth produce harmful biochemicals. These compounds cause gums to recede, become red, swollen, and to bleed. And continuing with the cleansing article, here's how often you should really shower. How often you should shower is a question with no simple answer. Experts explain when and what to wash and what to wash in the shower. Shower time. Wellness trends come and go, but one thing we always assume was in style was good hygiene. Now we're starting to wonder, given the topic of showering or not showering, as the case may be, is being hotly debated on social media and by celebrities. Quite a few have fessed up and say they have no problem skipping the daily ablutions. One is actor Jake Gyllenhaal, who told Vanity Fair he finds bathing less necessary at times. On Dax Shepard's podcast, Armchair Expert, Mia Kunis and her husband Ashton Kutcher said it wasn't really a top priority for themselves or their kids. Meanwhile, the actors Rock and Jason Momoa came out as shower fans on social media and in interviews. Is skipping a shower as gross as it sounds? But even more importantly, does it really have an impact on health? Well, it can, according to Andy Gonzalez, M.D., a board-certified dermatologist at River Chase Dermatology in Miami. Thanks to buildup, dirt, sweat, and some consequences of not showering enough, including body odor, acne breakouts, dead skin buildup, fungal infections, and oily hair, wow, that's a lot of stuff, not showering enough can also increase the likelihood of getting sick. Of course, there's nothing wrong with skipping a shower now and then, and there are some risks to overdoing cleanliness and hygiene, too. To find out how often is often enough when it comes to jumping in the shower, we asked Dr. Gonzalez and another expert some questions. And although there's no one-size-fits-all, the pros share their insights to help you determine best for your body. What determines how often you should shower? How often you should shower depends on a few things, according to germ expert Philip Tierno, M.D., a microbiologist at NYU Grossman School of Medicine. Here are some things to consider. First, activity level. One variable that determines how often you should shower is how active is your activity level, according to Dr. Gonzalez. If you are someone who engages in daily and sweat-inducing activities, you would likely need to shower every day, she says. People who exercise regularly should shower regularly, or at the very least freshen up post-workout until they can bathe. However, if you don't participate in any physical activity during the day, it may be unnecessary for you to shower each day. There are a few skin conditions you can get or worsen from not bathing or showering. One is dermatitis neglectica, where you get brown patches on your skin made up of dirt, oil, and dead skin cells. Yuck. If you hit the gym and opt not to shower, you could also increase of getting an infection. One example is impetigo. That's I-M-P-E-T-I-G-O, a contagious bacterial skin infection that causes red sores. Another is ringworm, a contagious fungal infection that is easily spread not only by skin-to-skin contact, but by touching infected surfaces and objects. The symptoms are scaly, red, and itchy skin. Plus, the same type of fungus also causes athlete foots, too. Sweat and body odor. Some people sweat more than others, whether or not they participate in physical activity. So similar to how active you are, how much you sweat in general is another way to determine how often you should shower. Some people don't perspire as much and don't have heavy odors, Tierno says, and they can get away with showering less often. A lot of people don't use deodorant of any kind, and they would be more likely to have an odor after a few days, he says. so it will be almost required to bathe at a particular frequency depending on the individual. In short, the more you stink, the more you often need to bathe, that is, if your body odor is a concern to you and, of course, to those around you. Skin type. Another type contributor is your skin type. If your skin is on the oily side and is prone to acne breakouts, showering every day would be wise, according to Dr. Gonzalez. But you should only shower a few times a week if your skin tends to be dry and flaky, so that you don't deplete the oils of your skin further. People with dry skin who shower too often may irritate the skin barrier, leading to even more dryness and redness. Those with skin conditions like eczema, or psoriasis may also experience irritation if you overdo showering. If you have a skin condition, your doctor might recommend showering less often and using cool or lukewarm water to avoid irritating your skin. The season. People adjust their showering frequency with seasonal change. The summer brings hot, sticky weather, which often causes body odor, Dr. Gonzalez says. However, winter leads to drier skin. Those living in humid or hot climates may opt to shower more often since they like you to sweat more. How well you clean your butt. Dearness is holding back. Cleaning your butt or wiping as much fecal debris around the anus as possible is an especially important task between showers. And knowing how to wipe your butt, well, helps people prolong or extend their time between showers, too. I didn't realize we were getting this deep. The idea is to make sure people wipe their anus in an appropriate way, Tierno says. That's a very important aspect of maintaining good hygiene. Following an initial wipe, consider doing a double-duty cleanse the area. Use wet tissues with either a salt water solution, half a teaspoon to 1 teaspoon to a quarter of water, or even a mild soap solution to clean the area well. Anal wipes are also an option, too. This practice isn't a bad idea, even if you do shower daily. In a pinch, you can use wet tissue with plain water, but the plain water shouldn't routinely be used because it can be irritating. So how often should you shower? There is no generic rule about how often you should shower. According to Dr. Gonzalez, it mostly comes down to personal preference. Some people feel that showering every day is a must. Some people believe that showering 2 or 3 times a week is sufficient, she says. In general, male or female, it's okay to skip a day or so, depending on the circumstances, according to Tierno. Alternating your bathing every other day is perfectly fine, he said. There's no one size that fits all, unfortunately. It's not going to hurt to engage every day or every other day if you choose to, according to Tierno. However, Dr. Gonzalez does suggest showering no more than once a day to keep the skin at its healthiest, and focus on cleaning these parts particularly. How often you shower is as important as how well and where you're cleaning. So it makes sense that Dr. Gonzalez recommends the focusing on cleaning the dirtiest parts of your body. These areas include the underarms, in between your toes, the groin, the hair, and the breast, per Dr. Gonzalez. Any crevices in the skin should also receive extra attention in the shower, as they get the grimiest and sweatiest, she says. Again, Tierno drives home the importance of cleaning the butt area. People who often need to shower more or less often. Since most teenagers participate in physical activities, they are the age group that should be showering most frequently, according to Dr. Gonzalez. Plus, teens beginning puberty experience an increase in body odor. Meanwhile, children and older adults do not necessarily need to shower as often as teenagers to maintain their cleanliness, Dr. Gonzalez notes. And, of course, individuals who engage in work where they come into contact with debris or germs, such as custodians, garbage collectors, and butchers, may want to shower more often than those who remain in an office all day. The bottom line, when it comes to the right amount of showering, once a day or every other day seems to be the rule of thumb. But remember, more isn't always better when it comes to showering. Overdoing it could lead to dry, itchy skin. Tierno's best bit of advice is to remember that you know your body best. Only you can determine exactly how much cleaning your skin tolerates and needs. Continuing on the body health and showers, etc. theme, how about 9 things your body odor reveals about your health? Body odor can be a sign of more than you simply forgetting to swipe on deodorant. If you smell fishy, you might have a metabolic disorder called trimethylaminuria. This means the body is unable to break down certain compounds found in some protein-rich foods. A fishy odor is released in the sweat, urine, and breath after eating fish, eggs, and some vegetables and legumes. If you smell like poop, you could be extremely constipated. When your digestion is severely impaired, smelly chemicals are produced in the gut that eventually cause stinky bowel movements when you do finally go. These same compounds could also seep out in your sweat, making you smell a bit like a septic tank. Oh, gross. If you smell excessively sweat for no reason, you could have hyperhidrosis. This condition causes excessive and unpredictable sweating outside the normal reasons like exercise or warm temperature. If you notice an odor after sweating in the cold or when you're not moving, talk to your doctor. If you smell bitter, you could be suffering from liver damage. Although more common symptoms of liver damage are digestive problems, nausea, and internal markers like abnormal fat metabolism, external signs like a bitter and offensive odor can also be present. If you smell after a hot flash, you could be pregnant or going through menopause. Both cause hormonal changes that can change your body's thermostat, making you feel extra hot out of nowhere and triggering your natural cooling response, which is sweating. Pregnancy also sends you into sweat glands into overdrive and blood flow increases elsewhere in your body, including your armpits. If you smell like rotten eggs, you might be eating too much red meat. Too much meat, particularly red, plus an inability to digest it well can lead to a sulfurous odor, which smells like rotten eggs caused by sulfur-containing amino acids it contains. One small study found that women rated men's body odors as more attractive, pleasant, and less intense when they ate no meat for 2 weeks compared to when consumed red meat, according to the University of California, Berkeley. Well, that's interesting. If you smell mild, you're getting older. In a study from Monell Chemical Scent Center in Philadelphia, volunteers thought body odor from an old age group smelled less unpleasant and less intense than odor samples from a younger age group, and not at all like mothballs. If you smell like a bar, you probably drank too much the night before. When you consume large amounts of alcohol, excess that the liver can't metabolize can be released into your sweat and out through your pores, making you smell exactly like what you just drank. And here's how often you should really be washing your hair. Do you really know how often your hair needs to be washed? Experts say it depends on your hair type and texture, as well as lifestyle and environmental factors, and the overall health of your hair. Washing your hair. According to Cleveland Clinic dermatologist Shilipi Kirlipatal, MD, most people don't need to wash their hair every day, and every other day, or even second or third day, is sufficient. How often you wash your hair depends on a few factors, such as your hair type and texture, your lifestyle, how often you work out, and even where you live, because things like pollution and humidity have an impact on your hair's cleanliness. How often and how you wash your hair affects both how your hair looks and the health of your scalp. To have hair that looks its best and a scalp that's free from flakes, avoiding these healthy hair mistakes is a good place to start. For healthier hair that looks great from the follicles to the ends, pay close attention to your specific hair type's needs. Here are tips for keeping your hair looking and feeling best. Well, what I would like is somebody to give me back about 70% of the top of my head, which has no hair. How often should you wash your hair? According to Catalina Droulard, hairstylist and owner of 316 Hair Haven in Kehi, Hawaii, how often you should wash your hair depends on your hair type and texture. If you have an oily scalp or fine hair, you're likely best off shampooing every day. Coarse or dry hair, meanwhile, may be better off only being washed once a week to prevent further damage. The more you do to your hair, coloring, highlighting, blow-drying, curling, straightening, etc., the less it should be washed, advises Alex Pagnanis, a hairstylist at Solo Salon in Chicago's West Loop neighborhood. Your wash schedule and suitable product choice could be discussed with a professional. In the meantime, less is more. Almost every other day or every 3 days is usually often enough for most types of hair. You may think you're doing your locks a favor by washing it as often as possible to help them stay extra clean. But it's possible to wash your hair too often, and washing every day is too much for most people, Droylet says. You could be shampooing too often if your hair feels dry and brittle. Or it's possible you may be using the wrong type of shampoo for your hair. Daily hair washing, even with quality products, is still too much washing. It can dry your scalp and ends, Pagana says. When an over-the-counter product is used every day, the scalp reacts and creates an oil in an attempt to replace the natural oil just stripped from the hair, thus leaving the need for everyday washing. I recommend a quality salon product and scalp training to remove away from washing your hair every day. How to choose a shampoo and conditioner. It's important to use shampoo and conditioner that is right formulation for your hair. But that's it. It's easy to get overwhelmed with all the shampoo and conditioner options lining the shelves. According to Drouillard, you can generally expect to get what you pay for with hair care, so it can be worth it to devote some extra cash to your hair care routine. An increasing number of people avoid products made with preservatives known as parabens and foaming agents called sulfates, as both have been linked to health issues. The good news is that you can easily find shampoos and conditioners that don't contain them at the drugstore or stores where you all can also get advice from the staff. Choosing a shampoo and conditioner largely depends on your hair type and texture. If you have color-treated, dry-damaged, or thin hair, you should look for products designed specifically for these characteristics, as well as avoiding the habits that cause thinning hair. Drouillard recommends Paul Mitchell Clean Beauty Line, which is made of natural and sustainable vegan ingredients and offers options for dry, damaged, frizzing, and normal hair. Drouillard strongly advises against using clarifying shampoos more than once a week. She also typically doesn't recommend 2-in-1 shampoo and conditioner products, especially if you have an oily scalp. Dry shampoo is becoming increasingly popular, but some stylists say it's not something to rely on in place of hair washing, although it's a great tool to have when you don't have time to wash, dry, and style your hair. You can use dry shampoo for several days in between washes, depending on the amount of natural oils you produce, McGinnis says. But if it's making your scalp itchy, dry, or flaky, use a scalp exfoliant to take a day or two off of using dry shampoo. Shelley Streens, open and master stylist at Oh Baby Hair and Day Spa in Bloomington, Illinois, has a brilliant dry shampoo suggestion. I tell my clients to use dry shampoo after styling on day one, Streens says. It starts absorbing excess oil immediately, and you can get an extra day of no shampooing. How much should you lather? They say lather, rinse, repeat has been debated for decades. Is it really necessary, or is it just a ploy to get you to use shampoo faster? Turns out there's some truth to it. According to Drouillard, if you're not shampooing every day, or if you're shampooing after a sweaty workout, you should always lather up and rinse out your shampoo twice with each use. Should you use conditioners? Once you've lathered up and rinsed out your shampoo, you should also follow up with some conditioners, as Drouillard says. If you don't have oily hair, you can opt to just condition on days when you don't wash your hair to give your locks some added moisture. No matter what type of hair you have or how long your hair is, everyone should be using conditioner when they shampoo, Drouillard says. If having limp or fine hair makes you want to skip this step, the conditioner you're using may be too heavy for the hair's texture. When massaging in your conditioner, focus on applying it to the body of your hair, especially close to the ends. Drouillard recommends never putting conditioner on the scalp. It can lead to buildup, and rinsing with cold water, which helps close to the cuticles and promotes smoother, shinier hair. If you don't already comb conditioner through your hair, you need to start now, McGinnis says. After rinsing the shampoo, squeeze the excess water from your hair, I wish I had enough hair to do that, and then pull it apart so that it's not all converged. Then put conditioner from mid-strand to ends. Use a comb or detangling brush to distribute more evenly. You can also try a styling-approved hair mask for deeper conditioning. After the wash. After you wash your hair, be gentle when toweling dry, as your hair is weakest when wet. Rubbing your hair vigorously can cause breakage. It can also rough up the outermost layer of your hair and a cuticle, creating fizz. Microfiber towel wraps are terrific for gently drying your hair. Drouillard recommends avoiding heat tools like blow dryers and hair drying whenever possible. If you must blow dry, use a heat protectant silent such as Paul Mitchell NeuroPrime Heat Control Blowout Primer or Advena Brilliant Damage Control every time. Boy, they're sure advertising a lot of stuff here. A word about dandruff and conditions. Itchy scalps are not only uncomfortable, but it's also embarrassing to see flakes on our clothes. If you have dry, flaky skin on your scalp, you might find relief from one of the dandruff shampoos. But if you have scalp psoriasis, a common chronic skin condition caused by an overactive immune system, you should try one of the best shampoos for scalp psoriasis. If you're experiencing itchy scalp and grease, you may have a very common skin disease called seborrheic dermatitis. points out Adele D. Hamovic, MD, a clinical associate professor of dermatology at New York University Langone Medical Center. Seborrheic dermatitis causes a red rash, scaly patches, and itchy skin. Although you may think it's best to avoid disrupting your scalp with this condition, dermatologists recommended shampooing more frequently and avoiding products containing harsh sulfates, she says. If you're experiencing any type of scalp irritation, it's also important to be mindful of your technique. Aggressive scrubbing can be detrimental, so make sure you're gently massaging the shampoo into your scalp with your fingertips and not your nails. If you're finally experiencing persistent itching or irritation, persistent hair loss, or significant hair thinning, Dr. Hamanovic recommends seeing a dermatologist to rule out other underlying conditions or to potentially try a prescription remedy. And as we roll over to Consumer Reports, let's look at another issue for health, better, safer drinking water. Many Americans still drink water with unhealthy levels of toxic chemicals, heavy metals, bacteria, and other contaminants. Here's how to test yours and to clean it up. 50 years ago, Consumer Reports published a groundbreaking investigation into the nation's drinking water. Its title is "Is Water Safe to Drink?" The answer, for the most part, was no. Our water was often contaminated with bacteria, virus, asbestos, and lead. Testing and treatment were inadequate. Money to fix the problem was almost non-existent. And new concerns, including thousands of new synthetic compounds about which little was known, were emerging. Later that year, the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act was passed, with Consumer Reports' strong support. It was a triumph of consumer protection that authorized the new Environmental Protection Agency to set legal limits on contaminants in drinking water. Today, while the nation's water is in many ways safer than ever, it remains vulnerable to threats old and new, says Ronnie Levin, an instructor in environmental health at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health in Boston, and the lead author of a September 2023 review of U.S. water quality in the Journal of Exposure Science and Environmental Epidemiology. Compared with half a century ago, she says, a lot of things are better, but a lot of things, surprisingly, are not. True, the EPA has set limits on many contaminants, like arsenic, but experts warn that those limits are often too high. We can kill pathogens in our water, but still suffer disease outbreaks when treatment falls short, and research has identified risks posed by byproducts of the disinfectants used to kill those germs. What's more, millions of Americans drink water from private wells that remain entirely unregulated. Perhaps most alarming, we know much more about the health risk of thousands of synthetic compounds that CR long ago, especially concerning our per- and polyfluorocarbonyl substance, or PFAs. These forever chemicals are ubiquitous in consumer products, persist both in the environment and in bodies, and are linked to some cancers, immune problems, female infertility, and other ill health issues. Almost half the nation's tap water can contain at least one of these harmful chemicals, according to a recent estimate from the U.S. Geological Survey. And tests by CR a few years ago detected PFAs in 117 of 120 water samples taken from taps across the country, with more than a third of those above levels that CR scientists believe should be the maximum. Also, similar to 50 years ago, the EPA's ability to regulate contaminants lags behind industry's ability to develop and unleash new and potentially harmful chemicals into the environment. The agency recently proposed landmark new regulations that would limit how much certain PFAs are allowed in drinking water. But questions remain about whether the proposed limits will be strict enough to protect our health and health of our kids. There is also the problem that regulations often can't solve. Money. New lead pipes have been illegal since 1986, but millions of old pipes haven't been replaced, leaving the door open to crises like the one placed in Flint, Michigan. Water infrastructure everywhere is crumbling faster than funds can reach it, as residents of Jackson, Mississippi experienced in 2022. Water utilities across the country are scrambling to figure out how to cover the staggering cost expected to come with eliminating PFAS and other emergency toxins from our water. When the bipartisan infrastructure deal became law in November 2021, it included the largest investment in drinking water in U.S. history, $55 billion. Yet Eric Olson, Senior Strategic Director at the National Resources Defense Council, calls it basically a small down payment on addressing Americans' drinking water problems. In the meantime, you're probably wondering what you can do now to safeguard your water, In addition to making your home tap water safe, you might also want to know how to improve its taste and smell. Here's our step-by-step guide for doing just that. How to check your drinking water. One key outcome of the Safe Drinking Water Act was requiring water utilities not only to test water, but also to make the results public. That was a game changer in raising awareness about water quality, and has helped communities and individuals address problems as they emerged. But those reports, called Consumer Confidence Reports, or CCRs, are far from perfect. They can be hard to get and even harder to interpret. They may include only contaminants that utilities are required to test for, which means emerging concerns, such as PFAS, can be omitted. They primarily measure contaminants in the water leaving the treatment plants, not those that can enter water along the way to your home or in your home, such as lead. And they can't help at all if yours is among the estimated 23 million households that get water from a private well. Here's how to get fuller pictures of your water quality, depending on whether you get it from a public utility or a private well. If your water comes from a public utility, that's most of us. 90% of Americans get drinking water from one of 440,000 public systems overseen by the EPA. Get a copy of your water report. Despite the limitations of CCRs, start by getting a copy of your report. If you pay your own water bill, you should receive your CCR around July 1st each year. If you don't receive yours, contact your water supplier. If you rent or live in a condo, ask your landlord or building manager. You can also look for the report on the utility's website or search for it in EPA's website, epa.gov/CCR. Utilities serving more than 100,000 people must make them available, and some small ones do it voluntarily. Make sense of your report. Focus on the summary near the top of each report that shows whether any contaminants were found above government cutoffs, and if so, what the health risks are, what is being done to fix the problem, and what you should do in the meantime. For questions of your local supplier or the EPA Safe Drinking Water Hotline at 800-426-4791. See whether the report includes the PFAS. A growing list of states now require monitoring for some PFAS, and similar measures could be available soon in other states. So check your report to see whether it includes information about PFAS. Compare EPA cutoffs with other expert recommendations. One criticism of CCRs and the nation approach to water safety in general is that safety thresholds are often too high. For example, the EPA's maximum contaminant level for arsenic is 10 parts per billion, but CR and other experts say tap water should have no more than 3 parts per billion. So check the box on page 29, which gives information about common contaminants in drinking water. You can also learn more about contaminants in your local water, as well as recommendations from the Environmental Working Group for Safer Levels, by typing your zip code into the EWG's tap water database. Go to ewg.org/tapwater. Decide whether to test your tap water. Here are some factors for two common contaminants that help you decide whether to test your water. First one is lead. Your CCR will show average lead level based on water taken from a limited sample of homes in your community, not specifically your home, so you may want to test even if your report doesn't show any lead. That could be an especially good idea if you live in a home apartment built before 1986, or if there is a pregnant person or young child in your home. PFAS. Consider testing if your report does not include information about these chemicals, or if the threshold it uses are above the levels that CR recommends. 0.004 parts per trillion for PFAOA and 0.202 points per trillion for PFOs. Two compounds that raise a particular concern, 5 ppt for any other PFAs and 10 ppt for total PFAs. Testing may make extra sense if you live near a known suspected site that could be contaminated with PFAs. Such include manufacturing plants, airports, and military bases. One source for information, a map maintained by the EWG. Go to ewg.org/interactive-maps/PFAS_contamination. If you have well water, if you're among the minority of Americans that depend on a private well, you're largely on your own. You're likely to have to get water tested yourself and choose what contaminants to test for. To help decide what to focus on, ask your county health department what concerns are common in your area and whether programs exist to help cover the cost. All well water drinkers will want to check for bacteria. If you live near farmland, nitrates which come from animal manure and pesticides may be an issue. Radon, a naturally occurring radioactive gas that can get into water from soil, can be a problem in some places, so the EPA recommends you test for that too. For lead and PFAS, consider the same factors as those listed above. The EPA recommends that well owners test their water every year and test immediately if there are reports of contaminated groundwater in your area. If there are significant changes near your well caused by flooding, construction, or other activities, if you replaced or repaired any part of your well system, or if you notice a change in your water color, taste, or smell of your water. The best way to test. If you decide to test your tap water, here's what to do, whether it comes from a public utility or a private well. First, be wary of the many do-it-yourself test kits sold online or in hardware stores, and wish to test a sample of water in your own home without sending it to a lab. It's not always clear what they test for or how accurate they are. Instead, the EPA recommends using a certified lab. Go to epa.gov/DWLab CERT. The test can be pricey. Some cost more than $500, depending on which contaminants are included in the test kit. Your health department may offer free or low-cost testing. If you need only a lead test, the nonprofit Healthy Babies Bright Futures leadkit.hbbf.org offers a low-cost one. You could also try one of the mail-in kits described at the right, and we'll talk about that. That CER is tested. All involves sending a sample of your water to a certified lab. All performed well in CR's test, though they differ in cost for what they test for. CR tested mail-in kits. Home testing. The tests from national testing laboratories can look for PFAS, lead, and other contaminants. Simple lab tap score. MyTapScore.com. Municipal from $160, wells from $195, and for PFAS from $299. National testing laboratories. WaterCheck.com. Municipal from $195, well from $205, PFAS from $499. To order, call 800-458-3330. And CycloPure is CycloPure.com, that's CycloPure.com, for PFAS for $79. CycloPure tests only for PFAS, but includes more of the compounds than its standard test in the other two. It's easier to perform and costs less. Now, what shouldn't be in your water? The Environmental Protection Agency regulates about 90 contaminants. Some are familiar, such as E. coli and lead. Others are not. Who ever heard of pentachlorophenol, a type of discharge from wood-preserving factories? That's interesting. The EPA has set limits for how much of each can be in drinking water. But Kelly Hunter Foster, senior attorney at the Waterkeeper Alliance, says those can be higher than recommended for protecting health. For example, the public health is zero for benzene, but the EPA allows drinking water to have 0.05 parts per million of that chemical. The Environmental Working Group lists the federal legal limit for compounds, plus its lower recommended levels, at ewg.org/tapwater/ewd-standards.php. All right. We broke contaminants into groups and described how they get into the water and how they can affect your health. The short and long term, we also provide information about some contaminants such as PFAS that aren't yet fully regulated. Regulated items, microorganisms, including Giardia lamblia, E. coli, and Legionella. How do they get into water? Improperly treated human waste and animal manure. Small remote areas are more likely to have challenges because of insufficient resources and because the farther the water must travel to its destination, the more the disinfectants used to treat may lose their potency. What are the risks? Gastrointestinal illnesses and Legionnaire's disease. Disinfectant byproducts. Examples are bromate, haloacetic, acids, trichlorometamethanes. How do they get into the water? Chlorine and other disinfectants used to treat water can interact with the organic matter to produce other toxic chemicals. Well, that's great to know. Certain byproducts, while less harmful in the short term than bacteria, can be a risk to health over a long period of exposure. So what are the risks? Bladder cancer, liver and kidney problems, anemia, reproductive effects. Heavy metals. Examples are lead, copper, arsenic, mercury. How do they get into the water? Lead and copper can leach from pipes going into a building or from plumbing and fixtures inside. Arsenic and mercury occur naturally and are made more prevalent by industrial manufacturing waste. What are the risks? High blood pressure, kidney and liver damage for adults, learning deficits, and developmental harm to infants and children. Nutrient pollution. Examples, nitrate and nitrite. How do they get into water? The excess nitrogen and phosphorus come from fertilizer, detergent, animal manure, cars, sewage plants, and other sources, and can trigger algae blooms that can be toxic to wildlife and humans. What are the risks? Blood disorders called blue baby syndrome in infants. Pesticides and herbicides. Examples, alkylor, atrazine, glyphosate. How do they get into water? The chemicals mostly come from runoff of agricultural sites. Small amounts from individual home use and property disposed of can also add up. What are the risks? Cardiovascular and kidney problems, reproductive difficulties. Radioactive materials. Example, alpha photon emitters, beta photon emitters, radium and uranium. How do they get into water? These materials come from the erosion of natural deposits of radioactive minerals, as well as emissions and waste from the nuclear energy industry. What are the risks? Cancer and kidney damage. Unregulated. These are the examples that we've talked about before. PFAS included PFOA, PFOS, thousands of related chemicals that make products non-stick, water-resistant, and more. How do they get into water? Industrial waste, recycled human waste used as fertilizer on farms, and waste from countless consumer products. Some states mandate testing and treatment of some PFAS, but the federal limits are pending. What are the risks? Cancer, fertility issues, developmental problems, endocrine disruption, and high cholesterol. Microplastics. Tiny particles of plastic, some visible only using by microscope. How do they get into the water? Plastic products come apart with use and time, breaking into ever tinier fragments which can make their way into lakes, rivers, and oceans. Plastic fibers can even wash off clothes of our water supplies. What are the risks? No scientific consensus, but it may be linked to inflammation and increased exposure to chemicals that can disrupt hormones. Other contaminants. Pharmaceuticals, fracking-related contaminants, cytotoxins from blue-green algae, percolate, also known as rocket fuel, and 6-PPD quinone from road tires are just a few of the contaminants that many experts say would get into our water and harm our health but are not currently regulated at the federal level. Water trouble? What to do? If your local water report, the CCR, the Seals contamination of your water test or your water test comes back with alarming results, how concerned should you be and how quickly do you need to act? That depends on what you find. If the tests show bacteria such as E. coli or Legionella, contact your health department right away for help interpreting results. Depending on what type of bacteria the test finds, you may need to stop drinking the water entirely until it has been treated. That's especially important if there are people in your house who are vulnerable because they are elderly, very young, or pregnant. For lead, take kids who have been drinking the water to a doctor to check for high blood levels of this heavy metal. Consider doing this for adults, too. Next steps depends on blood levels. While PFAS in your water is alarming, testing your blood is not routinely recommended. For one thing, those tests are hard to find, expensive, and limited in the number of PFAS they test for. And they won't tell you whether your health has been or will be affected. And like many other contaminants, PFAS cause long-term rather than immediate health risk. So the best advice is to continue routine health checkups with your doctor while trying to avoid additional exposure. Whatever the contaminant, also contact your public water utility and health department to let them know that you found so that they can investigate and coordinate a fix, says Eric Olson at the National Resources Defense Council. If the utilities aren't responsive, contact your elected officials to put pressure on. Whether what you found is potentially harmful to your health or just makes your water look, taste, or smell bad, there are steps you can take to get the contaminants out of your water and start by using a filter. The problem with bottled water. Americans drink some 15 billion gallons of bottled water each year, around 45 gallons per person, according to the International Bottled Water Association. While many people may buy bottled water out of convenience when they're on the go, others may believe it's safer than tap water. Bottled water often undergoes some kind of filtering before being sold, so it can be a good idea if you know your tap water is contaminated, or at least until you've addressed the problem through filters and other solutions. Still, bottled water is not a good long-term solution for several reasons. First, there have been periodic reports, including from CR, of some bottled waters testing positive for heavy metals, PFAS, and other contaminants. Aside from potential concerns about the purity of the water itself, the fact that bottled water is typically packaged in plastic is problematic. Polyethylene terephthalate, PET, that's PET, the kind of plastic used in many water bottles, can leach toxic things such as antimony, bisphenols, phthalates, and microplastics into the beverage inside. Do you ever realize how horrible these names are? Also concerning, the manufacture and disposal of the plastic in all those water bottles is a major source of many chemicals that ultimately end up in and contaminate our drinking water. If people have concerns about their municipal drinking water, they should also know that a lot of that is because industrial contamination and the plastic industry is actually a really big contributor to that, says Rupa Krishnafan, Director of Research at Defend Our Health, an environmental health advocacy group. When you need water on the go, you're better off filling a reusable glass or stainless steel water bottle with tap water. If you drink bottled water, there are ways to do it more safely. Don't reuse single-use bottles. These break down more quickly than sturdier plastic bottles that are meant to be reused, and studies suggest that the microscopic damage can shed microplastics, says Susan Richardson, chemistry professor at the University of South Carolina. Don't let plastic water bottles get too hot. High heat can damage plastic and lead to chemicals leaching into water, especially when exposed for extended periods. So he recommends that you not store water bottles in your vehicle. Look for purified bottled water. CR experts that typical indicates that the water has undergone filtration before being bottled. Pick a filter, but not just any filter. Whatever your water problem is, a bad smell or taste from something like sulfur, an immediate health risk from bacteria or viruses, or a long-term potential health risk threat eliminate from PFAS, lead, or many other contaminants, there's a filter that can fix it. Don't panic, says Eric Yeagy, Director of Technical Affairs at the Water Quality Association. There are really simply in-home treatment solutions for virtually every water problem that you're likely to encounter. But the trick is to find one that works for your specific problem, and that's not always easy. For one thing, you can't necessarily trust the marketing claims that filter manufacturers make when it comes to contaminant removal. The specific words they use in those claims matter, and the differences can be subtle. For example, the only guarantee that a filter removes a specific contaminant is certification by a reputable third-party organization such as the National Sanitation Foundation, the NSF, Water Quality Association, WQA, Canadian Standards Association, the CSA, or the International Association of Plumbing and Mechanical Officials, IAPMO. Some companies may advertise that a product is tested to or meets a standard from one of those groups, but that's very different from being certified by one of them. Here's why. Certified by water filters are monitored and subjected to extensive long-term testing to see how they perform over extended periods. On the other hand, products that are tested to those standards may have undergone only a short-term test and by a lab with uncertain qualifications. So it's important to verify that any water filter you choose is certified by a trusted organization such as the NSF, WQA, CSA, or IAPMO. Next, make sure you choose the type of filter that fits your needs and your budget. There are several types to choose from. They include home water filtering systems, which will filter the water soon after it enters your home, under sink and countertop versions, which work on individual sinks or faucets, and water pitchers. Filters use one of two technologies, mineral removing or more technologies. Mineral removing ion exchange units, reverse osmosis, bacteria killing distillation, virus and bacteria infection, bacteria and disinfecting ultraviolet light, and most commonly contaminant-absorbent activated carbon blockers. Another important consideration is maintenance, Shaggy says. Filters are certified to handle specific quantities of water over their lifespan. They can get really full of the contaminants that they filter out, so it can be helpful to buy filters that indicate when replacement is needed. Or, if you hire a professional to install a system, Ask what maintenance was required and how much it cost. That's important because these costs can add up fast. And yes, the filter cartridges and countertop pitchers really do need to be changed as often as the manufacturer says they do. And there are several different types of filters. We're not going to have time to run through all of them, but I'll run through the top one. Water filter pitchers cost $20 to $110. The Brita Stream Rapids and the Kirkland Signature. Faucet-mounted filters, Zero Water Extreme Life, and Pure PUR FM333 and Brita Basic. Countertop water filters cost $101 to $217. Homemaster TMFRG Elite, Apex MR1050, and Amway eSpring. Multiple under-the-sink filters are Multipure Adversa, Brondell Coral 3-Stage Culligan ESEZ4. These connect to a water line under your sink and usually include a separate faucet to dispense filtered water. They use singly multi-stage carbon blocks, polypropylene filters, or reverse osmosis technology, which can add hundreds of dollars to the cost. Many of the under-sink filters tested by CR are certified to reduce lead, chlorine, PFAS, and other contaminants, and they all get high scores for reduced taste and odor, and they typically require a plumber to install. The water filter pitchers are an easy option for people who are on a budget or renting an apartment. Unlike some other types, they don't filter water instantly. Water flows through an internal collagen cartridge that cleanses it slowly while the pitcher sits. Most filter pitchers tested by CR have been certified to reduce chlorine, but only one is certified to reduce lead and PFAS. We found that most do a good job in improving taste and odor, but that's because some can be prone to clogging. That's the Brita is the one that does the really good stuff. And the countertop water filters are attached to your faucet and are usually divert water through a small unit equipped with a spout. Installation is easy. Just remove the faucet area and screw the filter into the faucet. But they take up space on your countertop. Basic models, such as most tested by CR, use common filtration to induce impurities such as chlorine, as well as funky tastes and odors. More costly units, such as a model from Amway, use reverse osmosis or ultraviolet technology that can guard against more serious contaminants, such as heavy metals, PFAS, or bacteria. And with that, we have just about run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next week, and thanks so much for listening.